This is the TriDot Podcast. TriDot uses your training data and genetic profile combined with predictive analytics and artificial intelligence to optimize your training, giving you better results in less time with fewer injuries. Our podcast is here to educate, inspire, and entertain. We'll talk all things triathlon with expert coaches and special guests. Join the conversation and let's improve together.
Hey folks, welcome to the TriDot Podcast. Really fun topic today as two of our TriDot coaches will teach us how to sharpen our triathlon skills. The training improves our fitness, but we still have some extra work to do in order to stay sharp in our tri skills. Our first coach joining us for this is Coach Joanna Namy. Joanna is better known as Coach JoJo and has been coaching athletes with TriDot since 2012. She's a co-founder of Hissy Fit Racing, a third-year member of the Betty Design Elite Squad, and now has 17 Ironman finishes on her accomplished triathlon resume. Coach Jo is qualified for two Ironman World Championships and will be racing in Kona coming up here in October of 2022. Coach Jo, I am pleased to announce, is now a full-time member of the TriDot staff as our coaching community manager. Coach Jo, welcome back to the podcast.
Thank you, Andrew. Happy to be here.
Also joining us is Coach John Mayfield. John is a USAT Level 2 and Ironman U certified coach who leads TriDot's Athlete Services, Ambassador, and Coaching Programs. He's coached hundreds of athletes ranging from first-timers to Kona qualifiers and professional triathletes. John has been using TriDot since 2010 and coaching with TriDot since 2012. John, pretty fun show today. You ready for it?
I am ready for it.
I'm Andrew, the average triathlete, voice of the people, and captain of the middle of the pack. As always, we will roll through our warm-up question, settle in for our main set conversation, and then wind things down with our cooldown.
Time to warm up. Let's get moving.
Miracle is a word that conveys something positive happening on your behalf. Typically, some form of divine intervention is implied, and usually when something is described as a miracle, it is not a day-to-day occurrence that happened, but rather an exceptional, standout, wow, I cannot believe that just happened type of event. And you certainly know when you are the beneficiary of a miracle. John, Joe, what was a time you experienced something in multisport that can only be described as a tri-miracle? John Mayfield.
So I often struggle with warm-up questions, but I saw your notes on this one, and my answer is better than yours.
I
feel like I have a good answer for this one. It's not anything specific. It's not a specific story. It's the whole darn thing. Just the fact that I am a triathlete is a miracle. All those things you described really... As I thought through this, it's the fact that I'm now currently a 9-time Ironman finisher. That, you know, coming from somebody I was overweight, I was unhealthy, I smoked, just kind of lived the party life, and now it's been such a transformation for me to become an athlete that trains on a daily basis, that's had some success in racing, and now. Even as far as my career goes, here I am on the top rated podcast in the space and, hanging out with guys like Mark Allen, like the whole freaking thing is just a miracle and, constantly reminded, you know, going to these events and meeting these people all across the country and, getting to go places where other people are taking vacation to go and experience these things. That's what we get paid to do. That's just like such an amazing thing and is not at all lost on me. So the whole freaking thing is just a massive miracle for me.
I mean, it's hard to even follow that. I mean, you're absolutely right. That is tremendously better than what my answer is going to be here. But I'll move to Coach Joe first. Joe, what is your tri miracle you want to share today?
Oh, now I feel like I need to be really sappy. I mean, I'm always the winner and I always have to beat John Mayfield. So I think it goes back to, you know, this was a hard question for me after so many different Ironman experiences.
Sure.
And my mom always says, God puts you where you're supposed to be in life. But I think he puts other people where they're supposed to be in your life. And, you know, going into St. George World Championship, I think you sometimes get very comfortable in your abilities and what you can do, and have expectations of a race day, and then you get your world rocked by an extremely difficult course and day. And it probably happened 10, 15 times during that day that in some of my worst moments, I would look up and the exact person I needed was there at the exact time. And this, you know, I knew I could count on John as my coach to be where he knew I was going to need him on the run course after an injury. But, you know, looking up and seeing Andrew Harley and Corey, like, right as I'm approaching the finish line. I mean, I couldn't have written a storybook finish, or, you know, exchanging the smooch with Mike Riley at the end, or seeing Daniela Ripp, you know, medal me. But even just friends from, you know, locally where I am, out on the middle of a bike course where you haven't seen anyone in a long time, and somebody standing there, that was a friend of mine, Susan Euler. It literally was a miracle when I laid eyes on those people in the exact moment that I was seriously doubting myself. So that whole experience in that day was pretty miraculous for me.
All right, Andrew, what you got?
At the time we're recording this podcast, my wife and I just did a weeks-long holiday up in Canada. We went to Banff National Park and Jasper National Park. We were flying home from Calgary. It was the night before our flight home. We were staying in downtown Calgary. And so I wanted to go for a run. And I'm walking my way to the river pathway to start my run. And I'm thinking in my head, man, I'm hungry. My stomach is grumbling. I'm going to be fading on energy. I want to be able to enjoy this run. If only I had like a gel or something with me. And literally, as I'm about to turn left onto this riverside pathway to start my run, I press start on my Garmin watch. I take three steps, and right to my right, I see a running store.
It's a miracle.
In my head, I was like, miracle.
It's a miracle.
So I went in. You know, they didn't have any of my Precision Fuel and Hydration gels. They didn't have my UCAN Edge gel. So I picked up a Campfire S'more flavored goo. And while I was talking to the guy, he was a really nice guy running the running store. I downed my gel, I threw it away, and I went for my run. So small miracle, but it made me wonder, you know, what are some other triathlon miracles, whether they're small like mine or whether they're bigger like John's and Joe's? We're going to throw this question out to you, our audience, so make sure you're a part of the I Am Triathlete Facebook group and find the post asking you, what is a tri miracle that you have experienced?
On to the main set. Going in 3, 2, 1.
Our show today is brought to you by our friends at Precision Fuel and Hydration. Precision Fuel and Hydration has a range of tools and products to help you personalize your fueling and hydration strategy so that you can perform at your best. Longtime listeners of the show will know them as Precision Hydration, but they've changed their name to reflect the fact that they've been helping athletes nail both aspects of their performance for a long time now. Everyone sweats differently, and the amount of fuel that we require varies depending on factors like duration and intensity of our activity. So a one-size-fits-all approach to fueling and hydration just doesn't cut it. Head to precisionfuelandhydration.com and use their free online sweat test and their quick carb calculator to understand your own fluid, electrolyte, and carbohydrate needs during training and racing. From there, you can book a free one-on-one video consultation with their team to refine your hydration and fueling strategy for your next race. As a listener of the show, you can get 10% off your first order of fueling and hydration products by using the code TRIDOT10 when you check out at precisionfuelandhydration.com. We do the day-to-day training to prepare our fitness for race day, but there are triathlon skills beyond simply just being fit that will help you execute on the race course. And today, Coach Joe and Coach John will teach us how to sharpen 16 race day tri skills. So John, Joe, as coaches who work with everything, just from new triathletes to average triathletes to experienced veterans, as you work on these skills with your athletes, how much of a difference can improving these skills make for an athlete on race day?
I think it can make a huge difference. You know, a lot of these skills, you know, get overlooked in training, and that is reflected on race day. It can be the difference between a catastrophic race day and a DNF or an injury versus having a very successful rewarding race day. So it is important to take time to learn about these and practice the tips we're going to share today and incorporate them into your training.
So we train day in and day out. That's really what we focus on is our fitness, our race readiness, all those things. But these are the kinds of things that really determine how well you're able to kind of get what you've invested out of. It's all about execution. So you can go arrive at the race with a very high level of race readiness, but if you don't properly execute, you're gonna waste potential. You're gonna be out there longer than you could have. You're not gonna place as well as you could have. So as critical as a component as fitness is, execution is also very important.
I'm excited to get insight from both of you on these 16 tri skills, and the first one is that swim start. And swim starts can be done in a couple different ways. You've got your rolling starts, you've got your wave starts, you've got your mass starts, you've got your indoor pool swim. So there's a couple different types of swim starts that athletes will encounter. How can we sharpen our swim start skills?
Yeah, I totally agree, Andrew. I think it's the swim start is probably one of the most overlooked skills as far as planning and practicing during training. You know, we spend countless hours swimming in a pool, a little bit of open water here and there. I coach a lot on the preparation for an open water swim, whether that's a practice or a race, in that almost all athletes have some form of anxiety when starting a triathlon, especially starting the swim portion. And again, I always go back to how do we practice this? Well, there is a mental component and a physical component to starting a swim. Mentally running through the steps and the timetable in the 10, 15 minutes leading up to you getting in the water, what are you going to do during that time? What are you going to think about? What is your mental focus going to be? And then as you start to swim, you know, what are my first steps going to be? What am I going to focus on as far as breathing, stroke, rotation? And so the more you plan that out, the better equipped you are to reduce anxiety, be more comfortable in the water, be more confident, have better form. And then, you know, that all leads to less energy exertion, a happier swim, more confident coming out, and, you know, shaving off minutes. So, you know, it's definitely something that has to be practiced, getting with a professional. If you don't know what that's supposed to look like, what that swim start practice or preparation is, it's good to get that information and to incorporate that into your training.
So a couple of other things, even taking a little step back, is first is knowing the course. That's critical. Swim, bike, and run. Know what the shape is, which way you're going to be turning, which are directional buoys, which are turn buoys, where is the sunrise going to be compared to how you breathe? So what is your goggle selection? It's all those kinds of things. Very common mistake I see is athletes that don't know how their wetsuit should fit. So oftentimes what we see is athletes that don't get their suit on properly, which then can lead to the claustrophobia, the panic, all that, or kind of in a best case scenario, they're not getting the range of motion that that suit should be providing them. So they're going to fatigue more quickly. Their technique is going to be diminished because of that. So know how your wetsuit should fit and then make sure that you're getting it on properly. And then especially in the cold weather, cold water swims, this is a great tip. I got to give credit to Jeff Raines for this one. We've talked about it before, is getting the wetsuit primed. So it is a wetsuit, it's not a dry suit. It is not intended to keep you dry. It is going to be a certain amount of water that is in that suit. And when that water is warm, that is what is going to keep your body warm. So if you jump in and the first water to fill your suit is 60 degrees, it's going to take you a while to warm up that water so that then the suit can keep you warm. What you can do, though, is provide pour warm room temperature water down the suit to begin with. And it works amazingly. Ever since Jeff gave me that tip, I've done it numerous times. Like when we jumped in the San Francisco Bay at Alcatraz and all that, we were golden because we brought a big jug of water with us and poured the water down the suit. And it allows that warmer water to saturate the lining of the suit. And then the body is warming that already warmed water. So then when we jumped in the 60 degree or whatever it was, San Francisco Bay, the suit was already saturated, so it didn't have to warm that water. So I think that's a great tip that I always want to share.
Nope. Great tangible tips from both of you. One thing I'll add is just whatever type of swim start you have coming up, practice it. The week of, 2 weeks before, you know, if you know you have a pool start or you're jumping in off a dock, you know, the next couple pool sessions, jump in a couple times and start swimming immediately off the side of the pool. If you know you have a beach start, find an open water swim venue if you can, where you're going to be, you know, jogging out into the water and starting that swim, just being comfortable with the type of swim start. Moving on, so once we've started the swim, we're out in the water, we're doing our thing. A triathlon skill that some people are better at than others is bilateral breathing. How can we sharpen up our swim bilateral breathing?
So first, just to comment on that, there's a lot of people who think that bilateral is better than unilateral. And especially in triathlon, that's not necessarily the case. I think a lot of that comes from pool swimming, where you're swimming for 50, 100, 200 yards, and then you're done. So you're not having to think as long-term as you are in a triathlon. Even our shortest races are an hour, give or take. So we're having to think 60 minutes down the road and how we're going to be using oxygen and utilizing what we have. So an advantage of unilateral breathing is you're breathing every stroke. You're getting in more oxygen more frequently. That is also going to not only help you through the swim, but come out with the water in a good state so far as that goes. Nothing against bilateral breathing. There's also kind of a myth that it helps you swim straighter if you're breathing to both sides. That's not necessarily the case. You can certainly it's much more technique driven, how straight you swim. So you can breathe bilaterally, and if you have something in your stroke that's causing you to swim crooked, you're still going to swim crooked. You can swim straight unilaterally. You can swim crooked unilaterally. So it really is kind of it's not necessarily something that we all have to implement, especially on race day. Now, it is a great skill to have. It's a good thing to have, like we've talked about with the sunrise and chop. There may be times where you may be getting a face full of water every time you breathe to the natural side. For me, it's to my right. On race day, I breathe unilaterally to the right side. But for me, fortunately, if there's a little bit of chop on the water and every time I turn to the right, I'm getting slapped in the face and the sun is blinding me. Fortunately, I have that ability to switch left or go bilaterally. And I think probably the best way to do this is implementing breathing to that non-natural side during drills. So specifically, there are certain drills that you have to breathe to a given side. So things like single arm lead, single arm swimming, you have to breathe to whatever side is dictated by whichever side you're swimming on. So those are just great opportunities as you're doing those drills to get used to breathing to that side that may not be comfortable. And then it's just implementation of it. Sometimes even within the TriDot sessions, it'll be prescribed. Like during a warm-up, it'll say unilateral breathing down and bilateral breathing back. And it's just as simple as that. Just implementing during your warm-up, during your cool-down, as something to just think on and work on. Just it's one of those skills is great to be proficient in, but you don't necessarily have to breathe bilaterally either in your training or on race day.
Yeah, I agree with everything John has said. Bilateral breathing is definitely for someone that is, you know, is customarily only breathe to one side. It's not even used to, you know, bilateral breathing in any sense. That is a skill that has to be practiced for a very long time to be comfortable. And my one question, and this comes down to whether we're bilateral breathing, what kind of wetsuit we're wearing. For my athlete, they'll come to me, say we have a wetsuit optional race, and they'll say, am I wearing a wetsuit or not? And I'm like, what are you most comfortable doing? Let's not throw any other wrenches into this race. It's going to be stressful enough. There are going to be things that happen. We are going to do everything during that swim that plays into us having the most comfortable and successful swim. And if that means you swim and only breathe to one side, then we are going with that. We're not going to try to change your swim stroke before a race. Now, if you've practiced this skill for, you know, a 6 months to a year's worth of training and you're feeling very comfortable with it, then yes, it is a great skill. There are some big time benefits as far as sighting, where you're seated in the water as compared to other athletes. There's some biomechanics and body movement benefits to breathing to both sides that affect you in other areas of triathlon. But overall, that is a skill that has to really be worked on and practiced and perfected for it to be beneficial in an open water swim.
Try skill number three. This is something that some people handle better than others, and it's something we can practice. Swimming in choppy water. If we have an open water swim and it is choppy, that is a skill we can work on. What do you guys have to say? How do you coach your athletes on a choppy swim?
This is very tricky. You know, some of us are more fortunate to be closer to the ocean, have more access for opportunity to practice in choppier water or water that has more current. But some of us don't have access to that. You know, my first response is exposure. You know, even if you get one opportunity to drive somewhere and you know, swim in the venue that you're going to be at or something similar, that's huge. It can just take one opportunity to make you feel more comfortable and better. And I'll have athletes that do that. You know, they know they're a little bit more nervous, anxious about swim and swim conditions at a race, and they'll take that one opportunity a month out from an Ironman or a half Ironman and go do that swim. And that's very beneficial on race day. As far as technique, there are a few techniques that we can instruct on as coaches, making sure that my athletes remember to do those during a race swim. It's harder, but I have to drill it into them that, you know, if you're feeling force, if you're feeling current, if you're feeling a lot of resistance from the water, or you're taking chop from one side, two techniques, and John has touched on some of this before, was that if you are able to breathe to that opposite side, that's golden. I mean, that's it'll take one time of you getting huge chop to the face and swallowing water when you realize that that's not going to be a good option. Breathing to that one direction. So if you can, you have the ability to breathe to that opposite side, and you stick with that, you're gonna have a much more successful swim. And secondly, it's a little technique that I always use with my athletes when they're feeling a lot of chop, or like Florida, for instance. John had a memorable swim last year there at Florida. Was that, you know, when you are feeling a lot of current, a lot of wave, if you can kind of press your chest, shoulders, head down a little bit and ride under that current. It's a very effective technique. One thing that happens with us as swimmers is, when our nerves are high, when choppy water and, really, really intensifies that anxiety, our first instinct is to ride a little high in the water. Our head, we cannot see, we're looking up higher, chest is riding higher, hips and feet drop, and now we've just doubled the resistance against us. So trying to get back to that completely flat position by pushing your chest, shoulders, head down just a bit, and you'll feel some relief from that chop, from that resistance.
Oftentimes, depending on which way that chop is coming from, you may need to implement a higher stroke rate. So if you are one that has a low stroke rate with a lot of glide, even a dead spot at the front, that chop is really going to impact you more, especially if you're swimming into the chop. That's also true for swimming into a current or something like that. The more dead spots you have in your stroke, you're effectively at that point neutral, and that current or the chop is going to push you around. So having that higher stroke rate is going to allow you to maintain more consistent momentum, which is going to help you better fight either a current or a chop.
The next swim skill that I have here on our list of tri-skill number four, is rounding a turn buoy. What do you guys have for us here? How can we most efficiently get around those turn buoys?
I think there's a lot of my athletes kind of have a little bit of a misconception. You know, they know they got to go around these red turn buoys that are usually located at the corners of a swim course. And that, you know, they get it in sight, they see it, and they think, okay, I've got to go around the left side of this buoy. They then turn their focus to aiming for a point that's left of that buoy. In all reality, if they aim dead straight on for the center of that buoy, they're going to be in a perfect position to get around that buoy. And I often talk to them about wanting them to have their side body touch the side of that buoy. It's funny. I think athletes have a little bit of fear of touching it sometimes. And like, I mean, it's not going to bite you. So getting up close, aiming straight forward. If you aim directly at it, you're going to come right up on it and get as close as you possibly can to it. I think most swimmers lose the most amount of time aiming to the left or right of a buoy and then being 150 yards away from it and adding to their total distance. So I always advise them aim straight for it, try to touch, armpit, side body around that buoy. And accelerate as you come off of that. You're gonna slow a bit in that turn, and to accelerate coming off of that buoy.
Triathlon skill number 5. The next one, this is also a swim one, drafting on the swim. The swim is a place that we are allowed to legally draft. You can save a tremendous amount of time by doing this effectively. Guys, how can we improve our skills swim drafting?
And you're exactly right, Andrew. You know, you can save a lot of time, but you save a tremendous amount of energy. And that's where a lot of triathletes, I don't think they know how important drafting can be in a race. You know, you're in a full distance Ironman, you're about to exert a tremendous amount of effort on a bike and then a marathon. I'm trying to save, you know, a lot of energy on the swim. And a lot of people think, oh, you know, you're a faster swimmer, you know, you're going to give full effort, you're going to, you know, try to swim this pace. I understand all of those things. But if I see a guy that looks pretty fast and he's lining up before me, I'm gonna try to get in the water, try to get close to him, try to hug that hip. As far as misconception in drafting, it tends to be most effective when you're kind of riding to the left or right hip of an athlete that's in front of you. And in doing that, you know, you decrease resistance tremendously, and you will feel that pull from that athlete in front of you. So, you know, as a newer, you know, triathlete or someone that is not, you know, very skilled at drafting, it is something that has to be practiced tremendously. You know, so if you have a partner that you can go out to the lake with, someone that is more familiar with drafting, this is definitely a skill that can be practiced and learned. And it is more of an advanced swim skill, but it doesn't mean that anyone can't learn it.
Yeah, as Joe said, even in the pool, and you'll feel it. You'll feel that kind of being drawn into that slipstream. For me, it gives me something to think about. I that's something I struggle with in open water, is especially at Ironman. You're in there for a long time, and it's like, you know, your face is in the water. What am I thinking about? If I'm concentrating on staying on someone's hip or staying on someone's feet, that keeps me mentally engaged. I'm not having to think about anything else. My only job in that moment is to stay on this person's hip or stay on their feet. Another advantage is, depending on the skill of that person that you're drafting on, it depends on how much faith you have in them. But if they prove themselves to be a good straight swimmer that is sighting often enough, it can reduce the amount of time that you need to sight. I wouldn't say to fully trust in anyone that you're on their feet or on their hip, that there's going to be swimming buoy to buoy. But especially if you swim 100, 200, 300 yards with that same person and they're consistently hitting those buoys, then I would drastically reduce the amount of strokes that I'm sighting on, which again is going to make me even more efficient and use less energy moving through the water.
You know what, John? I'm a little embarrassed that I prepared a podcast format and I thought through all of the skills someone needs to have on race day, and I came up with 16 of them, and I didn't think of sighting in open water. So this really, the title was going to mislead people. This really just became 17 triathlon skills, and the bonus skill we're going to throw in right here, right now, talk to us about how we improve our sighting in the open water.
Draft off of someone that is sighting really well, and then you don't have to do it.
You know, that's actually, you know, it's probably one of the most important open water skills, Andrew. You know, and taking it to the lake, any chance you have to get in open water, that's a perfect opportunity to sight, you know, a tree line, electrical line. Focusing and practicing on that is very, very beneficial. I often have my athletes practice sighting in the pool as well. You could sight something low on the deck, something higher in the building, but also, you know, in practicing the breathing technique John was describing before, sighting the lane rope to your left and right. That is mimicking exact race conditions where you're going to be sighting swimmers to your left and right.
Yeah, great point.
If you see someone to the left, you see someone to the right, you're in the right vicinity. You haven't drifted too far.
So for me, it's about finding that sweet spot of how often do I need to sight. So I want to minimize the amount of times that I'm interrupting my stroke, but still swimming straight. So for me, I usually start off on a cadence of about 3 to 5. I'll count 3 to 5 strokes, I'll sight 3 to 5 and sight. And then if I'm hitting it every time, and if I'm in a straight line, and a lot of this will have to do with conditions and how much is the water moving around, how much am I able to sight off those around me. And if I can start to extend that, I say on the high end, sometimes I can go as much as like 10 strokes. So now I'm doing a 10 count every time between sightings, but that takes validation. I'm never going to start a race sighting every 10 strokes. Because I mean, if you go 10 strokes and you've been swimming at a 10 degree, 20 degree angle, you may not know it, but you're way off. Or if there's a current that's pushing you, something like that. So it's kind of one of those things that was going to require some validation. And then when you make a turn, you're likely going to need to drop back and kind of revalidate because, you know, maybe the water conditions have changed. But for me, it's, and if I'm starting to get off on every fifth, you know, I drop it back to three. And then, you know, you'll find that sweet spot of how often you need to sight in those conditions.
All right. After our crucial bonus skill that we just threw in, we are now on to official skill number six, the final swim one I have on our list. How do we handle the swim exit? I mean, we spend the time getting faster at our swim, but then if we botch getting out of the water and take a little extra time to do it, those fitness gains were just negated. So how can we, as efficiently as possible, Coach Joe, get ourselves out of the water and running towards transition?
I think that starts as you're approaching the swim exit. I have my athletes mentally, I'm like, start thinking about what's about to occur. What are the steps you're going to take as soon as feet hit the ground? And that all starts with knowing that swim exit. Am I coming out on stairs? Will there be people to assist me? Take advantage of volunteers there. If they're hoisting you out, let them pull you out. Save energy in that department. Know if there's going to be strippers there, you know, wetsuit strippers. That's been, you know, iffy over the last couple of years. And now knowing that you're going to have assistance, take advantage of that. But I make them cite to me, what order are you doing this? Are you taking your goggles and hat off, cap off first? Are you undoing and latching the back of your wetsuit? You don't want to have those cap and goggles in your hand if you're trying to, you know, undo the latch on the back of your wetsuit. So there's definitely an order to that and to practice that. You know, there's no shame in being at the lake and saying, I'm going to practice this swim exit. You know, I'm going to use these stairs or this ramp to practice coming out and do that efficiently and quickly. The other factors there are you're usually pretty cloudy and confused when you come out of a long swim, usually short of breath. I will see athletes that are just hauling coming out of the water, and I'm sure they're podium contenders. That's fantastic, but it's also
good for them.
Yeah, good for them. Excellent. But it's also important. I tell my athletes this is an opportunity. You've just swam a very long way, and you are a little cloudy. You know, and take a few seconds to take some deep breaths as you're coming out and walking toward transition. Let your heart rate come down. You're about to do some pretty important stuff when it gets into transition, and you want to make sure that you do all of that correctly.
So just a practical tip, and this goes back to, I can't take credit for this one. I remember this tip from, I think it was the first open water session first open water clinic I ever did. I think it was something Cindy Reeves invited me to over a decade ago. And I remember them saying specifically, you swim until your hand touches the ground. So this would suggest, you know, some sort of lake or beach kind of deal where the water's getting more shallow as you approach. So not your stairs or that sort of thing, but you're much more efficient swimming than you are walking. But so often people are tired of swimming, and so they want to stand up and try to either run through the water or walk through the water. You're going to be so much more efficient if you continue to swim. And usually it's only maybe 5 or 10 yards at most. So that's to this day. I remember that's the thought I have. I'm going to keep stroking. And a lot of times I'm swimming between people who are standing up. But yeah, it's stroke until the hand touches the ground. That's the signal to stand up.
No, great point there, John. So I will say that now that we're starting to kind of talk about transition a little bit, there are a plethora of transition specific skills that I could have included on this episode, could have included on this list. I intentionally kind of avoided most of those because we do have a full hour long episode. It is episode 44. That episode is called Time Saving Transition Tips for Triathletes. So if you want to catch some transition wisdom from that episode, go listen to that full length episode. I've got just a few kind of specific niche transition ones here, but not a ton. So the one I'm calling this skill number 7 for this episode: how do you run through transition with your bike the most effectively? How can we sharpen that as a skill? I've seen some people moving through transition holding their bike, and they are awkward about it. And I've seen some people just glide like champions through transition with their bike. That is a time-saving opportunity by being good at it. How do we do it?
Well, I appreciate you've picked a couple of my favorites here. I've never been all that spectacular at swimming, cycling, or running, but I can transition like a ninja. So this is kind of my my space. Learn how to run with your bike by holding the saddle. I'm sure we covered that pretty extensively on that podcast episode. It's something that's kind of one of my hotbed issues. You can learn this in 5 minutes if you will just practice to set out. There's not a whole lot of skill to it. And it's going to do you well. Not only does it look cool, it changes where you are in relation to the bike. So if you are holding on to the handlebars or the handlebars and the saddle, that's going to put you right in line with the pedals. And that can lead to bad things. So, by steering and pushing by the saddle, you're going to be behind that. You're going to be more level, like with the back wheel, which is going to put you in a better place. And then it's also going to allow you to get skinny. So if you're having to thread in between people or a narrow space, maybe there's a bike and a bag and that sort of thing, you can actually get all the way behind the bike and still steer. It is easiest when you have momentum. It is a little bit harder. It's kind of like if you're approaching a stoplight on your bike, trying to through that track stand kind of thing. The slower you are, the more difficult it is to steer. But what you can do is get the bike off the rack and have that one hand on the saddle and go ahead and just get it started. Go push it, get that momentum, and that's going to be plenty to get you from there. And then just practice. Get a little bit of momentum. Try making turns onto the sidewalk, 90 degrees from the driveway to the sidewalk. And really, it's not that hard. Just practice it a little bit and you'll be great.
Triathlon skill number 8, the bike mount. This is something else that as we're leaving transition, I've seen people very elegantly get on their bikes. And we, you know, we'll talk about the flying mount, I'm sure. But even if you're not willing to do the flying mount, you can be very efficient and graceful in a regular mount, or you can take up a lot of time and be really kind of stumbly through your mount. So talk to us about mounting our bike smoothly and practicing that as a skill.
It's really going to depend on the distance of the race, how much these seconds matter. Sprint, it's everything. You absolutely have to get on that bike and be moving as quickly as possible. Ironman, there's a little bit more room, and then kind of in between. And it's going to depend on your goals. You know, if you are in it for the seconds or if you're in it for the minutes, kind of like Joe said earlier, it's really what are you comfortable with. Now, that said, I would recommend getting comfortable with an efficient, quick mount. And this has to do with starting with the shoes in the pedal. Now, you don't have to do the run and jump on the bike and all of that. In fact, I don't do that. I will start with my shoes clipped into the pedals. I use rubber bands on there to make sure that they are held in a horizontal position. I run through transition, holding the saddle, steering with the saddle. I get to the mount line, and that's when I will grab the base bar, grab the handlebars, and I simply step over the top tube and step onto that shoe with my bare foot. Stepping onto it, that is going to provide that initial momentum. Now I'm going, so now my other foot goes on top, and I will spin as I need to. It's simple. Just you can get plenty of momentum, plenty of speed up with your feet on top of the shoes. And then as I reach a place where it's straight, I'm not climbing a hill, very easily slip the shoes in. Always, always, always eyes up. So this is something that you need to be comfortable doing, not looking at it. I would suggest doing this, but practice, become efficient in it, and always remember to keep your eyes up.
I really like what John said about, you know, there's no shame in practicing this on the trainer. You know, absolutely. Eyes up, you're not going to watch this, and you're going to over and over and over again, you know, feet in, feet out, and practice this skill. I will say I do coach a lot of, you know, first timers for full Ironman distance. And what we often witness coming out of the water is athletes pretty shaken by a swim, pretty nervous, very shaky as they're coming out. They've crossed over the mountain line, and there is no shame in hugging a side of that chute, getting to the sure. far right, taking a few seconds to lock that foot in and get going. I mean, not everyone is going to be able to do that kind of mount with shoes already in there, especially if, you know, they're racing a longer distance and newer to the sport. And that is okay. That is totally fine to, you know, take a few seconds. It's way better than being in the middle of a chute and having tons of traffic and people trying to mount and get in each other's way. So I often tell them to, you know, take a few deep breaths, scoot to the side, lock one foot in, make sure you look back and that you're clear to go, and then get moving and you know, get that other foot in.
Triathlon skill number 9, we're out on the bike, we're riding, bike handling, like being stable on your bike, being comfortable on your bike, being a good citizen of the road, being able to make good solid U-turns. Most courses at some point you'll be making a U-turn. And I've had some go smoothly. I've had some where I thought I was going to run off the road. How can we practice our bike handling, turning, et cetera?
These aren't especially hard, but you know, it is confidence. You know, it's, I think back to when we were kids, we U-turned on our bikes, we did circles and donuts. The big difference was our feet weren't, attached to the pedal. So, you know, if we needed to drop down, we always had that bailout. So, you know, these are great drills to do like in parking lots and that sort of thing, to where you can start with a big circle and just get that circle tighter and tighter. Practice those U-turns, mark out, some kind of non, draw it out where there's no side effects. You know, like, don't necessarily go and find a tight 2-lane road with a ditch that drops off 8 feet to practice your U-turns. Go to a parking lot or some wide space, some abandoned road where you have plenty of room. Start wide and just get more and more comfortable bringing in tighter and tighter. It's just about practicing and being comfortable with all those skills.
And everything John said, a couple years ago, we did a bike handling clinic for brand new triathletes. And that was very eye-opening to me, because we're talking about U-turns and tight U-turns. And for them, it was, can I ride in the aero position for a quarter mile? Secondly, how do I go over a speed bump? These are all little techniques that most of us had to kind of just figure out on our own. There wasn't of, you know, and I'm hoping that, you know, like locally, we can have more bike clinics to show newer triathletes, or how do I make a left turn correctly? What am I doing with my feet, my legs, with my, you know, with my arms? That there is all technique to making, you know, efficient, close, safe right and left turns, especially in a race environment when you've got people all around you.
It is a skill to be able to eat on the bike, to drink out of the bike, to be able to grab bottles from a variety of places, to be able to grab nutrition out of different pockets and different places. How can we sharpen the skill set of eating, drinking, and grabbing things that we need on the bike?
You practice how you race. You know, it is, you know what you're going to be consuming on the bike. You know when you're going to be consuming it. Where is it located? Are you planning for that to be in a back pocket, in a bento box? Is it in a baggie? Is it solid food or strictly liquid? Practicing on all long bikes, consumption of your calories is essential. That's got to be practiced and perfected, and fail proof. If you've done it a million times and removed a, you know, cracker or a, you know, Uncrustable from a bento box, and it's so routine to you, then you'll have no problem on race day. I think there's a lot of new things happening with athletes on race day. Oh, I'll try this, or I'll shove these in a back pocket, and I'll try to remove it and undo a plastic wrapper with my teeth. No, that is, we increase the risk of wrecking, danger, hitting another, taking out another athlete. So, you know, as much as we practice, you know, holding aero position or practice form in our stroke, swim stroke, we need to be practicing how we're taking in nutrition on the bike. And then following, you know, race etiquette, race rules, and how we're getting rid of the trash on the bike and not throwing that, you know, to the detriment of someone behind us that might hit that. It's kind of silly, but I have my athletes do back extension on a giant yoga ball. And instead of just lifting up, I make them lift to the side like they're removing and replacing a bike bottle. And that's part of their strength training, because those are muscle groups we don't really engage unless we're practicing. So it's definitely back extension. But the caveat is, now do bike bottle, take and replace.
So one of the tried and true tips that I got years ago, and it has always worked, and is one that I always have passed on to numerous athletes, is going through the aid stations when you are taking something from a hand up. So a volunteer is holding a bottle or a gel or something like that, to avoid confusion with that person, as well as those around you. What I will do is I will point to the person. I will say, make eye contact with the person. And I'll, if there's something identifiable about them, I will call it out. Now, usually they all have like the same volunteer shirt. So like green shirt doesn't work, but you know, if they're wearing like a red cap or something, it's like you in the red cap, and it's, you know, I will point, I will make eye contact, and then they know I'm taking the bottle from them. There's no confusion. And then the person who's perhaps riding next to me or behind me also knows that. So that's just one of those things that works really well. It kind of almost guarantees a clean handoff. So you're not catching someone off guard. They're moving with you. A lot of times they'll start to kind of run with you. And that's just one of those things that it's all about communication in those aid stations. Those are dangerous areas. They're the most dangerous area of the race course. So communicate with the volunteers, communicate with the other athletes that are around you.
Moving on to skill number 11. It is a skill to be able to overtake properly, to drop back properly, and to practice the legal draft on the bike. Just interacting and being aware of other people on the road is a skill. What do we do here, guys?
This is a big one. It's easy to do, but it's oftentimes not done properly. So it's critical to know the draft zone. So for those racing Ironman events, it's 6 bikes, and you have 25 seconds to bridge that gap. So that's actually a pretty good amount of time. Depending on how fast that person in front of you is going, 25 seconds is pretty long for you to gap, to close that 6 bike length gap. And it's even shorter, in most other races. So it's important that every time we are in a race, we stay to the right. I see that all the time, and it's super frustrating. I raced over the weekend, and man, there were people who were not only not staying to the right, they were like riding on the left. And I refused to pass anyone other than on the left side because that's what the rules require. And so, you know, that's one of those things, like Joe was saying, it's just etiquette. And it's a penalty. It's blocking. It's not cool. And it's against the rules. So as far as actually passing and overtaking, it's kind of two things in one. You're passing them, but you also need to take advantage of the legal draft, as you mentioned. So what this entails is, a lot of times what we'll see is when someone passes, they immediately get over. So they're 6 bike lengths back, they get over, and then they will bridge that gap. But you don't have to do that. The rules provide for you to stay in that slipstream for up to 25 seconds. A pass is considered completed when your front wheels match. So you don't even have to truly pass the person. You have to match the person. Once you are even, once your front wheels are even, it is now the responsibility of the person who has been overtaken to reestablish that 6 bike draft or whatever the draft distance is in whichever race you are. So you could spend 22, 23, 24 seconds at an Ironman race, and as long as you are pulling even with that other person in 25 seconds, you have not done anything against the rules. But for those 22, 23 seconds, you were being more efficient because of that draft that you were in. Now, if you've got a motorcycle sitting right on you, you know, you may want to complete that a little quicker, because even when you get that penalty, it doesn't do you any. You could say, I've got it on my stopwatch, I was there for 24 seconds. They don't care. If they think you were there for 26 seconds, they're giving you that penalty. But so that's something that a lot of people don't take advantage of. And if you are the longer races, sometimes you are working through a field of hundreds of people. And if you are passing hundreds of people, that's hundreds times 25 seconds per, that you can spend a lot of time legally drafting. And it's not anything against the rules. It's certainly different than someone who's just sitting on someone's wheel and doing so illegally. But it's definitely something to take advantage of.
And I'm going to refuse to answer this question in protest of the 5-minute penalty that I received at the Ironman World Championships, as I could not pass the cyclist in front of me because we were going 3 miles per hour on an incline, and I get a penalty for drafting.
Joe, on behalf of the triathlon universe, I apologize that happened to you. And we'll move on to triathlon skill number 12. This is talking about the bike dismount. This, again, just like mounting the bike, it is a skill to smoothly get off your bike, and it saves you time on the race course. What do we do here, guys?
So it's easier than the mount, but it's a lot of the same stuff. You're just doing it in opposite order. So it's easier. It's a lot easier to come out of your shoes than it is to get in your shoes. It's oftentimes easier to release the shoes than to tighten the shoes. So I would say even start with this, but also same thing, start on the trainer. And always, always, always keep your eyes up. That is the biggest thing. If you're looking down, trying to figure out where that buckle or where that boa is, who knows where your bike is headed. So eyes up, do what you need to do to loosen your shoes. And it's usually just a real quick push down on the heel of the shoe and your foot will just kind of pop out. Do it to the other side. And in the meantime, you're riding with your feet on top of the shoes. And then begin to slow down as you approach that mount line. And there are two things that you can do. A lot of people will swing their leg over backwards, over the back of the bike. I have two bottles on the back of mine that really prevent me from doing that. So I go the other way. I step with my right foot up over the top tube. And so now I'm this is where it gets a little... It's probably easier than it looks, but you're standing on one leg, effectively holding your bike, but you're at a relatively slow speed by now. And then if you do it properly, if you slow down right, you can approach that mount line and then just step off and you're right into a jog, headed back to your transition rack, steering your bike by the saddle.
And again, this is one of these skills. I think I was telling John before we even started recording today was that please practice this 200 times successfully.
Oh, absolutely.
Before you attempt this in a race.
Do not be a liability on course. Yes. Do not put other athletes in a situation where you might wreck them and ruin their day because you can't.
Yeah, you take out athletes and you take out two volunteers all at the same time.
Sure.
This is something. And again, this doesn't have to be done. You know, it depends on your goals. It depends on the distance of the race. It depends on the circumstances involving that bike end. What is going on at that time at that bike dismount line? Are there 16 cyclists, dismounting around the same time? There is no shame in slowing and pulling to the side. You're also you're about to execute a second transition. So for my athletes, I'm like, I want you to put it in an easier gear, start to spin those legs out and start thinking about what's about to occur. What's going to happen? How are you successfully going to execute this next transition? So that's all in good timing in that last part of the bike.
Triathlon skill number 13 is once you get off the bike, it is very different running off the bike as opposed to just running. And it is a skill that we practice that we can sharpen to get good at running off the bike. And so when it comes to getting your legs under you, when it comes to getting those legs spinning and getting comfortable, how can we sharpen this skill at becoming better at running off the bike?
It starts with what Joe mentioned. Oftentimes, doing the last period of the bike in a higher cadence, it's great. We're oftentimes riding around a 90 cadence, kind of, again, depending on the course and the rider. But that's really where we want to be running is somewhere, give or take, that 90 cadence. So it's already... it's allowing those neural pathways to get used to that turnover of 90 times per minute. So it's starting there on the bike and then a good transition. So for my kind of rule of thumb, and this is really more so for short course racing, where I'm going really hard at a transition and I'm trying to get every second possible. I give myself a half mile. This is something I learned years ago. The first half mile is gonna suck. I can't do this for 3 miles or 6.2 miles. But if I give myself a half mile, it starts to get easier. So that's kind of my mental thought for the first half mile. I have a short attention span. So a lot of people have like an alert where they've run a mile. For me, it's every half mile. I just need to know I'm going somewhere. So when my watch chimes, I know I'm going to keep pushing. I'm going to suck it up. I'm going to be uncomfortable for that first half mile. I know that's what I got to do at a transition, specifically in a short course race. Now, it's kind of the opposite in a long course race. And this is where you really have to be careful. A lot of times you're excited, you're high on adrenaline, and you're feeling great. You're glad to be off the bike. You may look down and be running 30 seconds to a minute faster than your plan. And as great as that is, that can come back to bite you. If that's not your plan, chances are you're not going to run a half marathon or a marathon all of a sudden 30 seconds to a minute faster than you thought you were going to. but it may feel like you are. It may be a very easy effort. But unfortunately, I can also attest that sensation also often comes to an end somewhere around a half mile in. But it's just being cognizant of it. And like all these other things we talked about, I remember back in the first couple of years I was racing triathlon, those brick sessions were really tough. My legs felt really heavy. It was a very different sensation running off the bike than running fresh. All these years later, I've done numerous sessions for a number of years. And honestly, anymore, I don't have that sensation anymore. A run off the bike largely feels like a fresh run. Now, I'm not always fresh, but I don't have that sensation of the heavy legs, heavy feet anymore.
With my athletes, my first thing to yell is usually settle in. And that is often because I think athletes often take off too fast. Breathing gets out of control, heart rate is skyrocketed, and they don't ever really recover. So I do yell settle in, and I think they understand me to say, hey, maybe slow pace a little bit and think about that quick turnover. Think about quick, tiny steps, light feet. And when you kind of start to focus on form a little bit, it takes away some of your attention from the pain that is happening, or for me, because I hate running. Like, I hate running. I always say settle in, quick, small steps, focus on form, and then kind of monitor your breathing. And let's, you know, take some deep inhales. If you feel like you're really winded, not a breath, try to focus on that breathing.
Moving on to triathlon skill number 14 in the home stretch here, eating and drinking on the run. Now, we're not having to balance ourselves on two wheels here. It's in theory not as difficult as eating and drinking on the bike. But it's still, like, I am horrible at drink. I'm pretty good at taking gels while I'm running. I'm pretty good at popping electrolyte tabs while I'm running. I am horrible at drinking fluids while I run. It just ends up everywhere unless I stop and walk for a second. Talk to us about the trickiness here and improving our skills of eating and drinking while we're running.
Couple of tips. You know, you're talking about the spillage and you know, Gatorade going everywhere on a, you know, when you're trying to approach an aid station. So there's a couple tips here. First thing I always say, and that's going to be the most valuable thing, is there's no substitution for a practiced and perfected nutrition plan. So that's kind of above all. We're talking about timing and what is being consumed. That has to be practiced, long runs, so that it is your routine when you hit the race course. Secondly, kind of the same technique that John talked about as we approach an aid station on the bike, very similar on the run. I know you're not on a bicycle, but I definitely point to a volunteer. There's usually a lot more athletes around, and it's more confusing, a little more chaotic. And then I hold up two. For me, I always point at two fingers up to show that they put about an ounce in each of these cups. So I'm one that always holds up two fingers, combines the two cups. Squeezing the cup in the center at the top will make it like a very narrow spout. And it's a lot easier to be running and pour that Gatorade disposable cup in your mouth without a huge mess if you use this technique. And this is something that, yes, I did practice, because Andrew, this was something for years in Ironman. I was like, oh, I'm going to get these aid stations down quick. I'm going to be flying through them. And then I created this complete mess and chaos and got no fluid in the meantime. So that is a practice technique of squeezing that cup at the top, making more of a spout and getting that fluid in. I always tell athletes that struggle with timing and nutrition, setting alarms on their watch to make sure they are getting in the right amounts at the right time.
So this is another one that's going to be dependent on the length of the race and how long you're out there running. Like for me, when I'm racing a sprint race, I will hit the aid station, but it's to grab a cup of water to pour over my body. So I'm not necessarily worried about fueling my next several miles. Again, that's always, we're taking in nutrition for the future, for the next, usually it's that window of the next, somewhere in the next 15 to 60 minutes is what we're fueling. So I'm hoping to be done before that time period. So for me, I'm not looking. So for the sprint distance, it's just about grabbing a cold cup of water to pour over my head. But from there, you need to begin to start thinking about those calories, and they really become critical in those 70.3 and Ironman distance races when you are. Now, especially early on, you're a little bit fresher, so your stomach often is a little more friendly to that. But as that race progresses and that diminishes, so does your need for calories. So think about, you know, even what I just said there, we're fueling the next 15 to 60 minutes. So when you're a mile or two out, you know, now you can start to shut it down, and you don't necessarily need to worry about taking on those additional calories and fluid because you're near the finish.
Triathlon skill number 15 is running the course efficiently. So we talked kind of about U-turns on the bike. I mean, U-turns at pace in your Nike Vaporflies on the run can also be difficult. Running the tangents is a skill that we can practice and get better at. We can save a lot of time by just running the course efficiently. How do we sharpen this as a tri skill?
First, you got to know where you're going, especially if there's not a large crowd leading the way. And then from there, yeah, things like tangents are huge. Quick story here. I raced a sprint distance race over the weekend. I came out of T2 with a 22-year-old, which just totally deflated me. I'm racing as a 43-year-old, so I'm like literally twice this guy's age. And I was thinking, I can't hang with this guy. He's 22 years old, and he's like 50 pounds lighter than I am. Well, he pulled away, and I started reeling him in about a mile and a half in to where we were going to be climbing up to cross over a bridge. And as I was reeling him in, I noticed he was going around these curves of this ramp really, really wide. And every time I would take the tangent and take that shortest path, and I was making significant space on him. And by the time we made it to the top of this to cross over the bridge, I'd caught him. And a lot of it had to do with the fact that he just ran further than I did. So that was kind of one of those things. I couldn't believe, like, I was like, why is he doing this? Even in the moment, I had that thought of, why is he taking these turns so wide when there's absolutely no reason to? So yeah, taking those tangents, and that was a sprint distance race. So for there is that. And then, you know, they really add up when you're talking about half marathon and marathon distance. So you can do an extra 10th or even quarter of a mile if you're taking those turns wide and not taking those tangents. So there's a real penalty for not doing that. And then just kind of a practical tip on the U-turns. A lot of times we want to take them real skinny, get right up on that cone and almost do like a little dance around it. But that almost requires us coming to a complete stop. And the hardest thing to do is get going. So I would say on those U-turns, even if it's like a sidewalk width, take it wide. That way you'll still have to slow down, but it's about maintaining as much of that inertia, as much of that speed as you can. Starting from anything is going to be starting from an almost dead stop. So take a little wider, maintain as much inertia, as much speed as possible.
Triathlon skill number 16, the last one we are including on our list today, and this is an important one, particularly for your Instagram account. It is a skill to, while approaching and crossing the finish line, to take a dope finish line picture. What tips do you have as coaches for just nailing that finish line pose?
I will definitely toss this one to Joanna, who takes much better pictures than I do. But I will say, don't make it a finish line picture. Make it a celebration picture. Don't allow it to be a stop your watch picture. I bet 80-90% of those finish line pictures have someone posing, hitting their stop button on their watch. You can give it a couple more seconds, clear the finish line, let the pictures come. They're going to tell you what your time was, and whatever you have on your watch doesn't matter anyway. So just enjoy the finish line experience. Don't worry about stopping your watch. Don't ruin your picture by making it, I'm stopping my watch picture.
Heck, stop your watch as you hit the finish line shoot to begin with, and just enjoy the entire shoot without even thinking about your Garmin the rest of the day.
Yeah, I had some thoughts about this thinking. I think in my first couple of Ironmans, it was always about a quarter mile out, check yourself, girl. I mean, you know, get that tri-top pulled down, fix the top knot, bun, make sure you are looking stellar as you come across. And yeah. I actually think, you know, and sometimes I still say that to my athletes, you know, check yourself, or, you know, hand me something so you aren't wearing something crazy, you know, in a race. But now I think the most unbelievable photos of finish line is to feel all the feels. You know, I think it kind of took a recheck for me at St. George to just let it all go. I mean, it's, you know, you can just let the feelings flow. And I'm some of the greatest photos I've seen is like Andrew at Waco, or me coming through the finish line at St. George, and just, you know, it just being raw. And you know, you've achieved it. You've done the work. It is a journey, and it is a finish where you should be celebrated. And I think in all those feelings, that captures some of the greatest photos that I've seen.
Great set, everyone. Let's cool down.
That was a lot of tri-talk in the main set with our 16, but really 17, tri-skills that we are now armed and ready to sharpen. So I'm going to keep the cool down short today, and selfishly, I'm going to claim it for myself, as I occasionally do. I just wanted to give a quick shout out to our Calgary Tri-Daughters. specifically Doug French, Vanessa Ronxley, and Ronnie Andrews. In the warm-up, I mentioned our recent trip to Alberta, and several of our Calgary and Edmonton-based athletes gave me some vacation planning tips for that beautiful corner of the world. But even beyond that, it was July 1st, Canada Day, when my wife and I landed in Calgary, and normally I'm sure that is a day that folks are looking to spend with family. Doug and his wife, Susan, invited us into his home where we got to take part in a Canada Day backyard barbecue where Vanessa and Ronnie also brought their families over. It was just a perfect way to kick off our travels in Alberta, and so awesome of those Tridotters to spend their holiday with the Harleys. Big thanks to each of them for showing us some Canadian hospitality. And Doug, those turkey burgers were delicious. Well, that's it for today, folks. I want to thank Coach John Mayfield and Coach Joanna Namey for helping us sharpen our triathlon skills. Shout out to our friends at Precision Fuel and Hydration for partnering with us on the episode today. Head to precisionfuelandhydration.com to book a call with one of their sweat experts and use promo code TRIDOT10 for 10% off your order. We'll have a new show coming your way soon. Until then, happy training.
Thanks for joining us. Make sure to subscribe and share the TriDot podcast with your triathlon crew. For more great tri content and community, connect with us on Facebook, YouTube, and Instagram. Ready to optimize your training? Head to TriDot.com and start your free trial today. TriDot, the obvious and automatic choice for triathlon training.